The White Network presents The Heretics Hour with Carolyn Yeager.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and I'm glad you could join me tonight, August 5th, 2013. I am Carolyn Yeager, and I want to start out by thanking the three gentlemen who sent a donation to the White Network since Saturday. My Saturday afternoon program, when I briefly brought up a need for donations, and they are Ken W., Jim F., and Kevin H., and all told it added up to $80, so that is just great. That takes care of current needs. I shouldn't say that, but I also want to talk briefly about the separate costs of CarolynYeager.net and AllieWeaselTattoo.com. These two sites both belong to me, and they share a server that also belongs to me. And in addition to the server cost every month, which is actually higher than the one at the White Network, I pay someone a certain amount each month as to be the technical administrator, what I call it, the computer expert, to respond to emergencies and needs and things that I'm not capable of, or it would take too much time for me to learn about and carry out, in my opinion. So this is a necessary expense, one that I can't do without. And, you know, anyone who does this kind of work for someone else certainly deserves to be paid for it. And I've also bought a new computer, which hasn't arrived yet. I thought it would have arrived by now. I better check into it tomorrow. The one that I'm using now and that I've used for so long, and I'm really attached to it, but it's been showing distinct signs of giving up, and the version of Windows on it is really too old. Now I don't expect listeners or readers to chip in for my computer or my internet provider or my phone bill, which is something I would have regardless. But that it's just that there are trying to say that there are a lot of costs involved in keeping up websites, and of course the biggest cost is on my life. That's my choice, my life and my health. But that's my choice, and so I'm not complaining about that. I'm just asking that those who particularly like and or learn from those sites I mentioned, CarolynYeager.net and AllieWeaselTattoo.com, remember them if you can with a little donation now and then. Usually it's been going pretty well, but like I said, it's been slow the last few months. I do think that might be typical. I do appreciate everything that everybody sends, and I am not trying to make money off of any of this. Now, tonight, I'm just plunging into this program. I titled it what I did, which is there's no Adolf Hitler scholarship. Because I was, earlier in the week, I was objecting, or last week, I guess, I was objecting on the Daily Stormer to Carl Rattles, quote Carl Rattles, unquote, presentation of the occult Nazism on the Deanna Spingola show that was posted there. And my questions about Rattle are the same as everyone's, like who the heck is he and why does he write all the stuff that he writes in his spare time, so to speak. His name, as we know, you know, I've had questions about this man for quite a long time. And so as soon as I see or hear him, I get a little starts ringing in my brain, and I'm very critical of it. So I thought, since what I wrote about it, I should add to it, because while it's true that on this radio program with Deanna Spingola, he did denounce, he did say that it was all that the idea that there was occult, that Hitler was an occultist, or the nature of Nazism was stemmed from occultism and so on, was not true, and that was what the program was about. But I listened to the whole thing then, since I had kind of made, I had made a judgment about it before listening to it. But while it's true he did denounce the whole idea of occultism, I found a lot of problems in the program, and so I decided I would talk about that to start out tonight's program. And when I said that that people question him, I'm not the only one that questions him. I found that Metapedia has a whole page on him, which is basically one in which his reliability or his what would you call it, his believability is questioned, and his motives, mostly his motives, are questioned. Now, I have been saying that Carl Rattle is the name. Of course, that's a pseudonym for this person who runs Semitic Controversies. And I was under the impression that it was the name of an SS officer who had served as an adjutant for Otto Skorzeny, the famous, I don't know the best word for him, but, you know, he did a lot of daring and dangerous missions, and one of which was to rescue Mussolini when he had been imprisoned by the opposing forces, and they in some kind of a castle tower. And I don't know that that's not true, but I was, there seems to be that this real Carl Rattle from the war, World War II, in the SS, is a little bit hard to pin down. So I'm not exactly sure. He seems to be mostly featured in a novel that was made into a movie, The Eagle Has Landed. And I don't know just how much he is real or fictional. But it's a known name, and so our Carl Rattle here, Semitic Controversies, has taken that name. If it's kind of fictional, it's interesting that he would take a fictional name, because maybe there's a lot that's fictional about him. But that, again, is just speculation. Something I've taken from probably from this Metapedia page says that Rattle wants to convince his readers. Now, as I'm talking about Rattle now, it's the living person who calls himself this. Rattle wants to convince his readers that there is no large Jewish conspiracy, as many white nationalists assert, but rather that while Jews have significant power in Western society, the real problem stems from the character of their race, which he asserts is egoistic and destructive. And he has often said that conspiracy theories about the Jews, while common and understandable in the past, are by now actually ridiculous and harmful to the anti-Jewish struggle. Well, I can't agree with that. I have not yet been convinced about this biological Jew business. Of course, I know there's a biological Jew, but the idea that Jews behave as they do simply out of their biology and don't need to communicate together, or which would, and then plan things and then carry out their plans, which would be conspiracy, because they're criminal. They're of a criminal nature. And if they're not of a purely criminal nature, they're of a politically subversive type of nature. And they're against the interests of other people among whom they live, the other people who are in the majority by far, and they're in a tiny minority. So all of that is conspiracy, and I really don't have a lot of criticism of the International Jew that I've been reading with Hadding Scott on Thursdays on this network, and Hadding has more criticism of Ford and what's in the book than I do, and he is somewhat, I would say, I don't want to bring Hadding into it, I seem to constantly be doing that, I would say he's somewhat along the lines of Rattle, but I would, I will ask him that when Thursday rolls around. He can answer for himself. Because I know he doesn't think much of Carl. I don't think he does think much of Carl Rattle either. So I will go on to say that I think that one thing that, you know, I've been suspicious that this Carl Rattle might be Jewish, and, you know, impersonating an anti-Jewish person. I don't like to be a nut about suspecting people with no basis for it. But as I've expressed many times, I think we need to be suspicious that there are a lot of people among us who are not what they are presented as being. And so you have to question that when that question comes up. Another thing, well, I'll say this first, what I've got written here. One thing that Jews hate more than being seen as genetically flawed, I think, is that they conspire to commit crime and rule the world. So in that sense, then, if that is true, which not everybody would agree with, I'm sure, but if that is true, then Carl Rattle could be working in the Jewish interest to even though he talks, you know, about them being flawed as a race, he just detracts from the idea that they are conspirators, which I think is what upsets them the most, what they most want to get rid of, what they most want to shut up, what they most want to suppress. And I, from the time I've ever read or listened to Carl Rattle, read him on BNN Forum, and then looked at his website and tried to make sense out of it. And then listened to him, because Deanna Spingola has had him on kind of regularly. I don't know, he's been on several, five or six or something times that I'm aware of. Listened to the show, or part of it anyway. I do not feel good about this man. And I had a commenter writing in at the White Network saying I'm going by my feelings and accusing people of things based on my feelings. Well, I'm accusing people, if I accuse people of things or question them, it's not based just on my feelings. But I do put a lot of stock in my feelings in this way, that it's always been very true that when I have an instinctive dislike, or, you know, suspicion, it's not feel good, just not like somebody when I hear them or see them or something, it always pans out that they are at least not good for me. And so it's not that they are, it's not that he would be have to be a bad person or a Jew or whatever, but that my nature and his nature do not blend together at all. Well, you know, there are people who I feel good about pretty much right away, and it stays that way because we go together well. There's nothing antithetical between that person's ideas and mine, or their motivations, or their interest, you know, their purpose, and so on. But when it is not in line with who I am, what I want, and where I want to go, and what I believe in, then I get that feeling, you know, that I just don't like them. I just don't feel good with them. And it doesn't mean that they're bad. It can just mean that they're not in line with me. And since I think that my motives are pure and good, and I know what they are, so then I have to, I have some basis for questioning people. So let me go ahead, let me see if there's anything else here on this page so I can get rid of it. Before I even get started with the actual business about what he said about the Nazi occultism, And I want to say right here, too, I'm going to veer off again, using the word Nazi, he uses the word Nazi. Carl Rottle uses the word Nazi. And I noticed that. And I have, too, but I have changed my mind about that. You know, I did this program a few weeks ago about whether to use the word Nazi. And I didn't really have a problem with it. But after that, after all the debate that we had about it on the White Network in the comments and so on, and I was, and I, even also on scrapbook pages, got it, it was going on there. And I was looking for examples of the word Nazi used by National Socialists to show that it wasn't invented by the Jews and that they didn't have this horror of the word and they refused to ever use it, that, you know, they weren't averse to using it now and then. But there isn't very much evidence of that. There is, it's used here and there, but it's not much. And what really, what I found myself after it was all over, when I was, I suppose, copying a quote from an article that was, that used the term Nazi twice in this, part I was copying and pasting. And it offended me, and I changed it. I took out the word Nazi and put in its place in parentheses, N-A-T hyphen S-O-C for National Socialist, that, you know, short, not having to write it all out, and using that hyphen too. And I realized that I had been influenced by Hadding Scott, that he had written one comment about it, giving his reasons why he thought it wasn't good to use Nazi, and mainly his, the argument he used that I didn't hear from anyone else was that it left out the socialist part, that National Socialism was always spelled with a hyphen, or just the, as in the German style, it's all one word without any, you know, break between the two words. Because as he pointed, it's one thing. It, they go together. You don't, it wasn't just nationalism. And the word Nazi comes from the word nationalist, and that's where, so it just gives that part of it. I thought that was kind of convincing. And ever since then, I found myself, you know, not liking that word anymore and not wanting to use it. And I notice it and I change it. When I'm writing, it's easier to do. So, if I use it here, it's because I'm reading it from somebody else. But, on this Metapedia page, some of the things that, Carl Rattle has, some of the positions he's taken, that people are questioned, National Socialist question, for example, are that he thinks that the conspiracy thing, the conspiracy theories he doesn't like, and he doesn't think that Jews were responsible for the 9/11 attacks. He considers that a crank conspiracy theory. So that's kind of shocking to me. I realize that there's a lot of people that could be responsible, but certainly to say that the Jews were not responsible for it brings up some question. He also says that he denies that Einstein plagiarized I had it in my mind, and now it's, you know, the big theory, I do believe that Einstein did plagiarize it. Well, he was able to take credit for it because all the Jewish powers, you know, helped him do that. Whereas other people who developed it, were working on it in the beginning, were left out. So, the relativity theory, theory of relativity that Einstein is credited with. Then Rattle says that doesn't think Stalin was Jewish. Well, I don't really think so either, so that's no big deal. But he seems to believe in Freudian psychology and ascribes hidden sexual motives to people. And the other, there's some I don't think are too important. What I do want to mention is that he argues against the Khazar theory, which is widely accepted among nationalists. Well, I'm not that well versed on that, and I haven't been too interested in getting involved in it, that one. But here's the one. He denies that Bolshevism is a Jewish phenomena. I find that, you know, I know there are people who take that position, and I haven't read what he has said about any of these things. But, you know, there's a lot there that is, controversial. So maybe that's why he calls his site Semitic Controversies. I don't know. That could be. To move on here, I better move on. Let's see. Okay, we're still going. My focus is, church scholarship, you know, because Carl Rattle mentioned in the interview with, in that particular program, wasn't an interview. He decides what to talk about, and then he gets on and talks about it, and she just listens and tells him what a great scholar he is. And that's where the scholar thing comes from. Partly it was Deanna saying, you have such fantastic scholarship. And also, Rattle talking about, academic scholarship and using the term we, including himself in that category of, and saying, well, we don't have any scholarship on these matters. We do have scholarship on this. What he is saying is that there is some scholarly material which confirms, you know, certain things, and other places there isn't any. But he's always using the term we. Now, he says he's an academic researcher, but he doesn't have any position that he mentions. Of course, he uses a pseudonym, so he doesn't want people to know who he is. He does say he lives in New York City, though. I thought that I read somewhere that he said if the people, some of his friends there knew what he was writing about, knew about this Carl Rattle business, they would be quite shocked. I don't know how that can be, really, but that's what I thought. I think I remember reading that one time. But so to talk about scholarship, you know, and I say there's just this idea of what we call scholarship. And there's what's considered Winston Churchill scholarship. There's Franklin Delano Roosevelt scholarship, or what they would call it. And there's, you know, MacArthur and Eisenhower and any famous person you can name that's not a part of the Third Reich. You can say, they say that there's, you know, that they've been treated in a scholarly manner and books are written and so on. And, but they're all in a friendly mode, although as time goes on, some become more critical. But everything about Adolf Hitler is written by hostile forces. Even those who would like maybe not to be so hostile, they are unwilling to do that because they don't think their books will be published. So everything is prefaced, even the most friendly ones, if you can. The only one I think of on that is Buchanan. Pat Buchanan, that they have to preface it with disclaimers that Hitler was an evil man who destroyed millions of innocent lives, but still maybe not everything said about him is true. You know, that's how they go about it. You know, he's still responsible for the Holocaust. He's responsible for so many things, and so we can't think that he was a good man. But other people were not so good either, and that's the best that can be done for Hitler. And that's just recent, like with Pat Buchanan's book on Churchill, Roosevelt, and Hitler. That book that was so popular. I read that book too. It was pretty good. But not as good as you'd like it to be because of this hostility that continues. And so bias is not scholarship. If you have to keep any kind of bias alive, then it's not scholarship. So I can't imagine that there is any scholarship about the occult Hitler or occult Nazism. And before I get into comparing these, oh darn, I wonder if I got that page up. Ah, here it is. Okay, I'm going to bring it up now. So before I get into that, I have to find my place again. I want to talk about, I just came upon some, like what might be a site that's talking about scholarship. Well, it's from foreignaffairs.com, and there's a Jew there named Stanley Hoffman, and he's written a review of three books that he calls scholarly books on Hitler, and one is by Ron Rosenbaum, who's Jewish. He's around all over the place, and his book is Explaining Hitler. And then there's George Victor, doesn't call himself Jewish, but he's a French Frenchman who came to America. I think I'm positive he's Jewish though, and he wrote Hitler: The Pathology of Evil. Now, you know, that has to be a Jew. And then Fritz Redlich, who's a Jew from Vienna, he doesn't want to say he's a Jew either, and he tries to pretend like he's just an Austrian. But his second wife is named Glass, G-L-A-Z, which equals to Glass, G-L-A-S-S, and both of them are Jewish through and through. Excuse me. Here, all these books are written by Jews and reviewed by a Jew. So there you go. That's the scholarship that we get. I'm just going to read this. Stanley Hoffman says, Hitler continues to fascinate and bewilder. That's why they have to keep writing about him, because Hitler does continue to fascinate and bewilder, and they just can't, you know, they have to get rid of that fascination and also the bewilderment, which is also could be taken as questioning, you know, wondering why, you know, what is the truth about this man? So they want to convince people. So they keep writing these crazy books about him. Hoffman goes on to say, after John Lukacs' recent study of his role as a revolutionary leader, well, Lukacs is a Jew too, we now have three books on Hitler's psychology, motivations, and peculiarities. Rosenbaum, a literary journalist, well, he's a journalist. He writes articles. Seems particularly interested in finding out whether Hitler was convinced of his own rectitude or was a manipulative Machiavellian. His investigation, which is not easy to follow, takes him through various episodes in Hitler's life, such as the suicide of his half-niece. Well, they love to go into that. And then I bet that took up a big part of the book. And then they you know, think about, speculate on all kinds of various scenarios of between Hitler and his niece. And then going on his Hitler's sexual mysteries. So it's supposed to, I don't know what, there were no sexual mysteries in Hitler's life, but supposedly they want to make him out to be. And they, you know, and the studies of Hitler scholars such as Hugh Trevor Roper, Alan Bullock, David Irving, George Steiner, and Daniel Goldhagen. Well, these are considered Hitler scholars simply because they've written books. And the first three are British, and the last two are Jewish, and the British are unable to be unbiased or just neutral about Adolf Hitler. I really do think the British try as they, yeah, they're so often said, well, they're, you know, oh, look at, he said this and that. So, you know, he's being more fair-minded. Well, they're just not as extreme. They say some things, but they're not neutral, and they are not able to be. Of course, Germans are not able to be either, but for a different reason. There are some telling vignettes here, but it's not clear whether this jumble of disparate materials amounts to much. So he doesn't think too much of Rosenbaum's book. And when he doesn't think all that much about Victor's book either, and Victor is a psychoanalyst, and Redlich is a psychiatrist. So these are the people, you know, a journalist, a psychoanalyst, and a psychiatrist who are supposed to be writing scholarly books about Hitler. But this is what everything turns out to be, you know, like this. But he really likes Redlich. He says, Redlich has defined his book as studies of the life and character of an individual as influenced by disease. And Redlich's book, according to Hoffman, it is a scrupulous work of scholarship. So he says that Victor's book is a little bit, you know, questionable, but Redlich's book, which is titled The Hitler Diagnosis of a Destructive Prophet. That's the one that Redlich wrote. And it's a scrupulous work of scholarship that reviews and often dismisses many of the stories that have been circulated about Hitler. It also provides a reliable and thorough review of his A Weird Dictions. That's this word I looked up and it doesn't even exist. I don't know if it's a mistake on the page. Maybe it means his weird addictions. It's probably, but it got transposed. A reliable and thorough review of Hitler's weird addictions, crises, and psychological characteristics. And Redlich's diagnosis, though, he says, is that Hitler was not antisocial or borderline hysterical, but politically paranoid. So, you know, he's trying to act like he's getting rid of all the worst stuff, but he still comes up with something called a paranoia. And he concludes that Hitler was in full control of his acts and therefore too dangerous to be a member of the human race. So this is what is supposed to be a work of scholarship, that Hitler, in the end, was too dangerous to be a member of the human race because he was so evil. And I'm going on too long about this part, so I'm going to move ahead from this. And I already covered that. All right. Now, I looked up Nazism, occultism, and so on, and I came up with a page from the IHR, the Institute of Historical Review, an article written in 1985. Well, the book came out in 1985. Let's see, there was reviewed by William Grimstad. It would have been around that time. So this was back when the IHR was still a well-running concern, as most of the good stuff on their website is. This is not anything you can credit Mark Weber with. But the book is The Occult Roots of Nazism, and it's written by Nicholas Goodrich Clark, a British UK member, and the publisher is in the UK. And it is considered one of the better books about the occultism of Nazism. And Carl Rattle mentions it on the program, and he also says that it is one of the better books, but none of it is really you know, is really something you would recommend. Now, the reason that I'm going to talk about this this review by William Grimstad of the Goodrich Clark book is because I say my is because I was wondering if everything that Carl Rattle said on that program could have been taken from this review by this Grimstad in the 1980s that took, you know, was done in the 1980s. Because I know that most of these facts and things that he rattled off, I think his name is kind of good because Rattle, when he talks, he rattles things off. He talks so fast and in this accent that's a bit hard. Not every British accent is hard to understand, but his is. And he talks fast and it's hard to follow. And he kind of rattles along in that he doesn't have it. He just says too much, I guess. I mean, he just goes on and without a pause and likes to mention lots of names and things that make it seem as though he just knows so much. But all this stuff exists, as I've said, on the internet. You can get all of it from Wikipedia pages. You know, there's hundreds of thousands of Wikipedia pages, I suppose, if not more. And you can, and every page has links to the subjects that they're, the people that are being talked about, to another page, and you just go on, and you can get all this information by all these people that he mentioned and that are in this book by Goodrich Clark, and so on. So, but it's also there's most of it is in this one article that was on it's on the IHR website. And I want to point out the similarities here. Carl Rattle starts out with Deanna by saying that the subject is the occult, and the occult, Hitler, and National Socialism. And he says it's a myth, and in large part can be considered an ancillary myth to the Holocaust. And he talks about that just a little bit. Well, Grimstad begins his paper by saying the gas chamber myth has been the centerpiece of establishment efforts to diabolize the Third Reich, and there has been a parallel attempt to link National Socialism to occultism. So he's saying the very same thing, ancillary in one case and parallel in the other. So, you know, right off the bat, I thought, maybe he got the whole thing just from this page. Well, he didn't get the whole thing from this page, but there's almost everything that he talked about is on this page. And Rattle goes on to talk about Christianity and the Third Reich. And he goes into that quite a bit. He says that he talks about Bormann being an atheist and Himmler a deist or a pagan. And there's nothing new there because that's well known. And he says that, you know, that the purpose in trying to show that the Third Reich is occult is to make people see it as evil, because you have to believe that it's evil for it to be, if it was occult, it was evil. And he's absolutely right about that, you know. But Grimstad said the same thing. He said linking National Socialism to occultism has served several purposes, making the Hitler period look spooky, demoniacal, or at least a bit kooky, and alienating people of traditional religious outlook. And again, that was because, as Rattle was saying, that the Third Reich was really mostly Christian, although some were not, and that they don't the enemies of the Third Reich then and now don't want Christians to to see them as their own brothers or whatever, and so they making it into something that stemmed from occultism rather than that these were Christian people who were involved in the National Socialist government and so on is better for them. So that's all true, but it's in both places the same way, exact almost the same words. Then Carl Rattle says that it was, mainly among English-speaking Christians in Britain and America. I already said this, but they didn't want, what they're trying to do is to explain Hitler, like the title of that book by Ron Rosenbaum. To explain Hitler, they wanted to separate Hitler and the Holocaust from Christianity. I already said this, you know, and so that's why making it appear to be occult, or saying it was an occult operation, separates it from Christians. So then they won't have this problem of English and American Christians saying, well, why did we destroy our fellow Christians over there, and why were the Christians following Hitler and National Socialism, you know, if he was so awful. So Grimstead, though, also said that Clark's book was published in England and then found its way to the United States. So it was the same audience, and that they would try to explain away the awkward fact of broad electoral support for the National Socialist Program in one of the world's most advanced Western countries. And which could be, they explained it this way, you know, they could explain it that an entire nation had been mesmerized by occultic Svengalis, you know, or these people headed by Hitler with their occult practices and so on. So this is how they could explain why the German people went along with Adolf Hitler. So then Carl Rattle says that there are two stages. One, Hitler was an occultist, and two, Germans were a pagan Hun race. And he talks about all that for a while, that the British, and then the Americans, tried to portray the Germans as pagan and open to occultism, and there was, they emphasized the idea of German occultists who were, you know, in Germany there was this folkish movements and paganish movements and studying of runes and old pagan old German practices and so on, and back to nature things, and you know, a segment of people who rejected Christianity, and this was going on for quite a few years before the 1920 even, and then all during that time too, and so they emphasized all of that. And this is in Grimstad. Also, Grimstad says that he mentions the book, The Morning of the Magicians, which Carl Rattle mentioned about this in about the same place in his talk. And but it wasn't published until 1960, and it was there was that book, and it was just Grimstead calls it a vast farrago of misquotations, sheer fabrications, and exclamation points. This book, The Morning of the Magicians, that was written in 1960. And the other was written in 1971. Another one he mentions is The Occult and the Third Reich by Michel Jean Anvert. And this broached the notion that the National Socialist era had been conjured up by wicked people behind the scenes, behind the visible leader. So then it really gets into, you know, weird stuff. These are the same books that Carl Rattle mentioned, said the same things. And then Grimstad mentions Trevor Ravenscroft, The Spear of Destiny, and J.H. Brennan, Occult Reich. And K.R. mentioned those two, same way, and said that, but he called he called the author of Which one? The Occult and the Third Reich. He called the author Louis Sundberg, where when I looked it up, it was, this is one by Michel Jean Engberg. And it was translated by Sundberg. And he says Sundberg is a Jew. But Sundberg is associated with the University of Tennessee. I can't believe he's a Jew. I'm not, unless this Engberg is just a pseudonym, you know, it's just another made up person, and the actual author is Sundberg, who is listed as the translator, and nowhere did I find that was the case, but maybe Rattle knows something about it, or maybe he's confused, or he's either confused or he knows something that nobody else mentions, but he didn't mention it in the program to explain that. He just kept saying that Sundberg was the author of this book. So either there's an error there, or he made it up, or he got confused, or he's just not explaining it. So, but I didn't find anything on that. And then Carl Rattle brings in Otto Rahn, as calls him an occult magus who worked with the Third Reich, and mentions, seems like, someone named Dusty Scalar, who I never could find anywhere. I don't know. That's what it sounded like. It's really hard to follow sometimes what he's saying. And he says Dusty Scalar's Occult in the Third Reich, but Occult in the Third Reich was written by Engberg, a Frenchman, and then translated by A.M. Sundberg. However, and then he goes, says that, then you get to more modern material. Peter Levenda's The Unholy Alliance. Well, that's real modern. That's 2002. And that's into the junk books. You know, I mean, they're all junk. But, they're really junk. But now, Carl Rattle says that, Deanna asked him about Borman. And I don't think he had anything very good to say about him. What he said wasn't wrong, but I don't think he was thinking about going into Borman that much. So I said, question whether not just Carl Rattle, but all these people all kinds of people who get up on these programs and so on and talk about Hitler and the Third Reich and related, you know, National Socialism or whatever, and try to present themselves as experts, and even if they don't say I'm an expert, the person they're talking to, or maybe callers, whatever, will say, well, you're such an expert, or they are called historian, and with a capital H before their name, when they're no way historians, and that irritates me too, and all this posing of being an expert on something when I say I don't find any experts, and I don't consider myself an expert either, and I don't find any experts on Hitler or National Socialism or the Third Reich. I just find students of it who are trying to learn about it, and mostly what people do is read up on it ahead of time, whatever topic they're going to be talking about, and bone up on that via Wikipedia and other sources on the internet, and then get on and talk about that particular thing. If you ask them about something else, they're at a loss, and they'll say, well, I don't want to get too far away from my topic of the day, and I haven't familiarized with that myself with that lately or whatever. They're not scholars. There's no scholarship. And I'm saying that for what I pointed out earlier in the beginning of the program, because no real scholarship has ever been done, because it's there's too much hostility, and it's not allowed to look at Adolf Hitler in a absolutely neutral way, which is what it has to be for scholarship. So you have detractors and you have supporters, and people see it through those lenses, and And so when Carl Rattle starts talking about Vorman, he says some things that I don't think are too smart, but he's a pretty smart guy. I'm sure I don't deny that he's a smart guy, but he might be trying to fool us a lot is what I think. He says that Vorman is the key to this whole myth about occultism because he is the one who prevented the direct link between the Christian churches and the Nazi party. He refused to allow any swastika to be put in any church, to allow Mein Kampf to be read in any church, or any official NSDAP symbolism to be used in any church. Now, I don't know where he gets that. Did he just make that up? See, I have to question. That's what really brings me around to saying, well, he's just another one of these guys who just, when he doesn't know the answer to something, he makes something up or he remembers something wrongly. But Vorman was certainly anti-Christian, but he didn't have, he may have tried to prevent this stuff, any connection between National Socialism or if he even might have, I don't know, nobody called it Nazism, but the National Socialist Party, the NSDAP, and Christian churches. He may have tried to do that. Well, I know he tried to do it, but that doesn't mean he succeeded. And there are pictures of churches. I've had some on my website where there are Christian, there are swastikas and National Socialist symbols inside the church, along with the symbols of the cross, you know, painted on the walls and so on. It's original from that original time. And there's one story that I came upon back when I did a couple programs on Christianity and National Socialism, that at one point, I don't remember it exactly, Vorman stopped something from being published, or he published something about Christianity that and the party that was not that that other people didn't, you know, had put forth, and he put a stop to it, and Hitler found out very quickly, and he overruled Vorman's what Vorman had done, and it went on through the way it was intended to. So Vorman didn't have the power to do all that, and I don't think that there's a lot of connection between the NSDAP and the churches, and I just don't go along with what he said there. Then he said the neo-pagans in the party were Walter Wurst, Himmler, Walter Dare, Ron Willigut, who was one of those pagan studiers, and but they were, he says, but they were not powerful. No, that's true. They weren't. I mean, well, Himmler and Dare were, had powerful positions, but they weren't able to direct, National Socialism away from Christianity or there was some, there was naturally some, conflict between the Christians in the party and the non-Christians who really didn't like Christianity. Like Himmler and Dare and some others, but it was usually resolved in a way that the Christians had their way. You know, I mean, the Christians remained the Christianity part remained intact, and so Rattle knows this. So he was saying in the beginning that he did say that the party was. The whole system was basically Christian, more Christian than not. But then some of the people that are mentioned, like Guido von List, came up. They come up in Grimstad also. Grimstad, this article, this actually, you know, it's from Goodrich Clark's book, but Grimstad is kind of going through it and writing a review of it. And there's the ideas of Guido von List and Jörg Lanz von Liebenfels, and we find that Carl Rattle talks about those people in the same way, you know, doesn't say anything any different. He says List wrote for various Volkish periodicals, meaning nationalist, Volkish meaning nationalist. For example, The Hammer, and says he doesn't really fit into the occult thing. And these people were not occult. Ido von List, von Liebensfels, there was nothing occult about them all. It was all about this German, you know, old German, non-Christian type of, thinking and, says List's happiest moments were when he was rambling through the Austrian countryside, and he was highly spiritualized, and it was about a pan-German movement and nationalism and, you know, love of everything German and so on, and Christianity just was something that was not originally German, you know, German enough for them. And they had something called, well, 60 seconds already. So I won't go through all this. They had a lot of organizations, but none of it was occult. And this is what is a lot of the background for the National Socialist Movement. A lot of these people are mentioned as saying, well, they were some kind of forerunners. But, there's some stories there. I can't mention it all, but everything that Rattle was saying, you'll find in this article, except later in the second hour, he talked about a few things, that were not, but they weren't necessarily about occultism either. So, because they had some questions and so on. So I'm going to continue just a little bit with this when we come back from the break, ladies and gentlemen, and then go on to something else. So stay with me and back in 5 minutes.
Sie liegen im Westen und Osten. Sie liegen in aller Welt. Und ihre Helme verrosten und Kreuz und Hügel zerfällt. Sie liegen verscharrt und versunken im Massengrab und im Meer. Aber es leben Halunken und die ziehen noch über sie her. Heute tobt mit frechem Gebaren man durch Blätter und Lüge und Glanz. Sie fielen mit 18 Jahren in einem anderen Tanz. Heute tobt mit frechem Gebaren man durch Blätter und Lüge und Glanz. Sie fielen mit 18 Jahren in einem anderen Tanz. Gezogen, um Beute und schnöden Gewinn, was heute verlacht und verlogen, es hatte für sie einen Sinn. Sie hatten ihr junges Leben nicht weniger lieb als die. Heute Höhnen es hinzugeben, sei reine Idiotie. Heute macht man mit funkelnden Wagen und Dünkel und Mammon stark. Sie starben an vielen Tagen noch hinterm Stacheldraht. Heute macht man mit funkelnden Wagen und Dünkel und Mammon stark. Sie starben an vielen Tagen noch hinterm Stacheldraht. demonstrieren, mehr Freizeit bei höherem Lohn. Sie mussten ins Feld marschieren, der Vater, der Bruder, der Sohn. Sie gingen die Heimat zu schützen und haben allen entsagt, was kann uns der Einsatz nützen, hat keiner von ihnen gefragt. Sie haben ihr Leben und Sterben dem Vaterland geweiht und wussten nicht, welchen Herben und welche Erbärmlichkeit. Sie haben ihr Leben und Sterben dem Vaterland geweiht und wussten nicht, welchen Herben und welche Erbärmlichkeit. Und welche Erbärmlichkeit!
Well, I guess you heard me clearing my throat there. Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. This is Carolyn Yeager, and this is The Heretic's Hour on August 5th, 2013. And I'm still going to say a little bit more about the Adolf Hitler scholarship and the idea of Karl Rattle's program about the occult roots of Nazism, and where he gets his information, and how much of a scholar he is. The other thing that was brought up, both by Grimstad and by Carl, was the Thule Society, and too much has been made about that also, which they both say. So that's known though. There's, you know, that's just people who are trying to build up a case for occultism in Hitler or his politics that want to say that this one had some kind of occult roots. Well, there's a man named Rudolf von Siebotendorf, that Karl Rattle mentioned also. And that he founded the Thule Society, and everybody's heard of that by now. But it had to do with a religious worldview of Arianism. And in Grimstad says in 1916 he began using the cultural society as a center for political action. And he was actually very political, this Siebotendorf. He used the Thule Society as a cover to divert Red suspicions. This was during the World War One and the ending of World War One, and it was Siebotendorf who purchased the Beobachter newspaper, which later was bought by the National Socialists and called the Volkischer Beobachter. But he was using all these as cover to stockpile weapons. And he was very anti-communist, and he schemed to kidnap the communist leader, Kurt Eisner. He infiltrated spies into the communist cadres and organized the Kampfbund Thule paramilitary group, which joined with other Free Corps units in the successful attack on Munich's communist government on April 30th, 1919. So he was a very good guy and a very important guy, and he did what he was what you'd call a real leader and activist and military leader in a sense, and he was brave, and he wasn't an occultist really. He was a German nationalist, and he says that he recognized the need for a new type of worker-based party. to deal with the unprecedented red threat, and he founded the German Workers Union in 1918. The most active member of this party was Anton Drexler, who went on to start the German Workers Party, which is the one that Adolf Hitler joined in 1919 and eventually renamed the National Socialist German Workers Party. So that's this guy, and that's the Thule Society, and it's not anything like what popular culture wants to make it out to be, and so many people believe it to be some kind of occult type. Doesn't even have to be so occultish occult, but just, you know, in this spiritual, strange Madame Blavatsky type of thing. Which it really was not. So, but later on, the Third Reich didn't have any use for this Seebottendorf and kind of didn't care too much for him. And he was a shrewd fellow, and he did a lot of good work. And then they bring up the Lovecraftian school, and Karl Rattle mentioned that, but it really has no importance. You know, it's another thing that too much is made out of. It's this fellow, Willie Ley, they connect him to it. But Lovecraft was wrote these books, and they are a bunch of futuristic type of stuff that they like. And they connect that to, you know, outer space stuff with somehow supernatural powers, and that somehow gets connected with occultism Willie Ley was just a German rocket engineer. But he did write a book, along with this, DeCamp fellow. They won an award for it, but that's all that's about. So, influences on Goodrich Clark, that's not important either. Okay, I'm going to stop with that and just say, tie this up with the fact that that Karl Rattle is overrated, in my opinion. And if anybody had the time, see, who has the time? You know, we go and we listen to things. We say, well, I'll learn something here. Even if it's not all good, I'll learn something. We're not that good at knowing what's worth listening to and what isn't, and what part to get rid of and what part to keep. So we really should be very careful. I think it's best for people to do their own research, or certainly if they hear, they can listen, but they should be doing their own research, and people should be very critical of what they're hearing from others, because there aren't very many scholars out there. You know, now a real scholar would be Kevin McDonald, but you don't find Kevin McDonald saying anything outrageous about anything. So I'm going to go now into my second topic, which is And I don't know why I'm even doing this either. I want to get into the problems of white nationalism. I said in my mailer that I was going to be talking about the problems of white nationalism and why homosexuals only make it worse. Well, so I'm getting myself involved in this again, because I really don't know what the answer for white nationalism or exactly what all the problems are. And I actually think I should stay out of it. And I like make a decision. I'm going to stay out of it from now on. Why should I talk about it? You know, I don't have any big role in it. And leave it up to the men to make it work or not or whatever. It's a men's thing. But I guess the answer to that, why I end up talking about it again, is because, I can't or won't stay out of anything as far as, having thoughts and opinions about it. And when you combine that with having a few radio programs, well, then the opportunity is just too great. So the other day, I'll start out this way. I received an email about white nationalism from a woman And I've decided to share what she wrote to me. She sounds sincere to me. I'm going to read the whole thing to you. It won't take too long. Let me get some water. She says, "Hey, Carolyn, I'm very new to learning about this truth movement and learning all I can. I am so glad to see an intelligent woman not only involved, but with a very nice site with coherent and well-researched positions." By the way, there's a name and and of course an email address, but I'm not going to give her name. Of course, this could be made up too. This could be some guy writing to me, and calling himself a woman, but I'm taking it as it is, as face value. And she says, "Since I have started to read about so many of the various truths that you and others report on, I have looked into so many sites. There is a real chance here for women to start something meaningful. As I'm sure you know, no real change can be effected without the involvement of women, not just for obvious reasons, but also because it can give legitimacy and a softer, more palatable image this movement is desperately in need of." To reach more of the mainstream people, I agree with her on that. To reach a group of more hardcore males, I suppose that's not true, but to reach a more mainstream or a more across-the-board group of white people in this country, I think that's absolutely true. Anyway, she goes on. In this first email, I won't go into so much, as I am sure you are well aware of most of what I'm thinking at this point, but I wanted to ask you how you feel about the treatment of women in most of the groups. Now, I am in no way some kind of outlandish feminist. I am a very traditional Southern lady, but I also believe in a classic education, women being given equal opportunities if they so wish. Of course, being able to have a default as stay-at-home mom or whatnot is ideal, but it's not what women have ever done with 100% of their life, even in the dark ages, she says, etc. Well, however, I was reading one of the bloggers, and I would say it'd be helpful to know who this blogger is, you know, but she doesn't give any of these details. So, she was reading one of the bloggers whom I think is calm and rational and puts forth a well-explained argument on every post, and I read what their ideal of what they were working for. You know, what their ideal is of what they were working for, and a lot of the basics of this I was on board with, but then it got to things like, girls past the age of 12 should not be able to continue with education except in rare cases. Women should not be able to have recourse in a divorce. All women are kicked out of the workforce completely, and on and on. Now, I would have just thought this was an off person, but literally every site I read is like that, and I was shocked because this person seemed to be so level-headed. Most of those points I mentioned are easy enough to argue against, but the fact is 99% of women will read these things and be instantly turned off. I mean, I cannot even be sure I want to be involved, and I promise I am the least overly emotional liberal woman I know. I think she means she's the least liberal woman, as well as over-emotional. She doesn't mean she's a liberal woman. She's the least over-emotional or liberal woman she knows. At least I would think for this to be make sense, it would have to be that way. The guys I see commenting over and over how domestic violence against women is actually such a small problem in white society that it is unmentionable. I know that it is a 100% falsehood, and that is probably the number one bit of violence that is on par throughout all races. Men just tend to turn a blind eye or put it out of their mind and pretend it doesn't exist. And if you are as big of a history buff as I am, you know that if we give back our rights, such as an education or the ability to defend ourselves as women, she means, we will likely never see them again. So basically, I'm asking, is this what the general consensus is? She means in white nationalism. I know for a fact that I am the complete opposite of overly sensitive, so it can't be that. Is it perhaps just certain groups? Is it something that we can become involved with early on to get the woman's voice heard? I have so many ideas for ways to get other women involved, but I have to say that if it's the choice between living in this Jewish-controlled society and going off to one where my daughters won't be educated and I will have no way to help them, relying on the state is not in my thoughts, she says, in parentheses. I think she means that she wants some power or influence within the society to help her children, her daughters, and, you know, other women and so on. I have to say I don't know that I could choose going with the white nationals. She means if it was a choice like that. Do you understand my concerns, and do you have any advice? I really respect you and your opinion, so I very much appreciate your taking the time to respond. Well, I did respond after a day or so, and I'm not going to read my response, but, you know, I told her I understood what she was saying, and I actually agreed with her. But it was, a sensitive, not the easiest topic, and I went into a few other things. I wasn't critical of anyone, saying we need to. Anyway, I'm going to leave that open for now, because if anybody wants to call in to talk about or to disagree or discuss anything I brought up in the first hour, or to get on this topic, you can do so, 830-443-4911, 830-443-4911. No undisclosed numbers, please. Now, the question is there something wrong with the white nationalist world that women fear being in such a system? And I think the fears are justified. And because of all the stuff that you find men saying about women, I have said myself, and I agree with her, that violence of men against women does cross the racial line. And there are so many white men, because I suppose they wouldn't do it, and they say white men don't do this. That just isn't true, that white men don't do it. They do it, and all women, many women, know that and have experienced it. And it might not be, real serious, but it's terrible to experience. So I think that women have a right to expect protection from within the community they're in. These are things I think that women are real to women. And do we need women? Do we want women? Those are all questions that have to be asked. And I think that when she says no real change can be effected without the involvement of women, I think that is true, as I already expressed how I see that. So I won't repeat that. This leads me to saying that homosexuals are the most anti-woman people I know. And even though a lot of homosexuals that you might know in your, maybe a lot of liberal homosexuals are not, because I used to think homosexuals were very, particularly friendly to women and easy for women to relate, get along with and talk with and be friends with and so on. And I'm sure that's a whole lot of women think that, and that's true. But if you get to the homosexuals in white nationalism, if you get to white nationalists or any kind of nationalist, well, we have to be, has to be white, but German nationalists, Greek nationalists, whatever. But mostly that I don't see it with those people, because they think in terms of their nation, their real nation. White nationalists are thinking in terms of race across national boundaries, And these homosexuals are very anti-woman in my experience. I don't have any personal experience with them, but what I'm seeing on the internet, and mostly, you know, I talk about countercurrents.com, and some other people are talking about that too. So I've got a little bit more about that tonight, based on what I just, the background I just gave. And I looked on their site today and saw something new, and that is that Michael Polignano, the co-founder who had been managing editor and webmaster of Countercurrents, has left Countercurrents at the end of July. He just left. He is relocating to Rome to reconnect with his family and heritage. This is what Greg has written in Italy, of course, has a thriving right-wing culture, so Mike's energies and talents will not be lost to our larger cause. We wish him the best and hope that he will report on the Italian scene for Countercurrents. It was always said that Michael and Greg were some kind of partners, sexual partners, but I don't have any facts on that, but anyway, he is now gone, so there's a lot happening there. And, you know, it seems to me Countercurrents has been weakening, and it may be that one of these days it'll disappear. I don't think it will be a sad day. But currently, they have an article by Michael O'Meara on the front page, the first one when I looked before the show. And, it turns out, I talked about Michael O'Meara last week, saying that I couldn't find any proof that he was a homosexual, and I didn't really know, but I did actually always think that he was and had heard that. But then, you know, that was a while back, and I didn't know whether I should say that, so I didn't. And then later in the comments, I was told that he is an outed homosexual, makes no secret of it. And he used to be a big a partner on that site too. But so he is homosexual, and he used to write a lot. He used to write for Countercurrents, and he's written some books, and he's got a very good reputation among these kind of nationalists. And but this is not a new article that he has written for Countercurrents. This is an old one that was from the Occidental Quarterly in winter 2010-11, and it was reposted here and re-edited in June 2013. And so it's about Francis Parker Yaki. Did I put the title of it down here? I don't have the title. But he writes about Francis Parker Yaki, and that he is a big, very, very popular and admired figure in white nationalism. I'm not so sure that I would agree with everything he writes, actually, the more I read about him. But he writes about the weakening of America, kind of, just real broadly. That's what I'm calling it. And he says some things that don't even make sense to me. You know, I mean, I'm not sure that he's right about this. His thing here is that the people who are fixated on comfort and pleasure are more inclined to feminine principles than to virile exploits or metaphysical perspectives. And right here, I think that this worship of this type of white nationalist, which ends up tending to be homosexual, to glorify some kind of great virile characteristics of white men, which is nice to think of, but I think it's overblown, and I don't think it's really relates to reality all that well. And it says that it says the Negro constituted a sort of paradigm for the country as a whole, Michael writes. He's basically saying that Europe retained its virile sense of history or honor and art and so on, and America gave in to the Jewish influence and the feminine matriarchal people devoted to routine and technicization that could not but orient themselves to the lowest common denominator. Now, this supposedly comes from Yaki. I think this article is sort of a synopsis of Yaki's thoughts in Imperium. That's what it seemed like. I didn't actually read the whole thing. It's pretty long, and I didn't have time at all to read it. I just glanced through it and copied some of it here. But and they say, he says that this is what allowed Jewish power to take hold in America, this feminization, this matriarchal thinking, blah, blah, in 1933. And he says it didn't happen in Europe. And yet he thinks, you know, so supposedly the Europeans are more, still more masculine and holding to their honor and so on than the Americans. Well, this is from Yaki, because he was very anti-American. And rightly so, after the war, which is when he was, when all this was going on, and World War II, and he saw the Americans and the British as the evil, along with the Jews, you know, and against Europe, and that's true. That was true, but I don't know how it fits today. He says in 1933, the year of the European Revolution, he calls it a European Revolution in 1933. That was when Adolf Hitler took power in Germany. And I don't know, he's calling it, though, a European Revolution, even though so much of Europe stood against Hitler. And when they didn't immediately in 1933, but they eventually did, went along with Britain and what it wanted in France. So... something, but, you know, it goes on. And that was the year of the election of Roosevelt. And he says that in 1933 also, the Jews acquired outright political control of the United States, I guess with the election of Roosevelt. So, and this is how he's describing this period. It's something that 1,000 years of effort had failed to achieve in Europe. So the Jews had never, he is saying the Jews had never gotten control of Europe, but they did get control of the United States in 1933. And actually it was earlier than that. And also they had control of Britain. And that's, I guess that's not Europe, in this, according to what's being written here. And it goes on, basically, you know, regurgitating Yaki's Imperium, but holding that Europe kept the true faith and ideals and manliness while America became enslaved to Jewish culture distortion. And I just think this doesn't even sound very, you know, like there's anything worth reading in this. It's... It doesn't get us anywhere. Where does things like this take us except to, you know, some kind of expressions of homosexual men about manliness and, you know, the great virtues that men have and so on. And that if any kind of influence of women comes in, that it weakens and it's Jewish and so on. Same old stuff. Same old stuff that, you know, Greg Johnson writes about, and they all write about there on that site. So that brings me to Greg's most recent article here, Racial, Civil, Religion. And I just want to comment on a few things that he wrote here. That from it, he says he's promoting the idea that, okay, it's time to come up with a civil religion based on race rather than a spirit, you know, a kind of spiritual or supernatural religion, believing in supernatural type of beings. And he said, this is his solution to the religious question, I guess. And he says, we must aim at displacing liberal universalism and establishing a white nationalist hegemony, a new civil religion for the West, which treats the preservation and flourishing of our race as the highest good. Well, that sounds good, doesn't it? And then he says, white nationalism must make the highest good of our race the center of a public cult, celebrating our identity, our heritage, our heroes, and our Faustian destiny. So, you know, Greg is presenting himself as a, proponent of, good, solid white racialism. And he says, that debates about Christianity versus paganism, are beside the point. There's no reason for that. But the critics of Christianity are wrong to think that Christianity is today the primary enemy, for the real religion of our time is liberal universalism, to which even the Pope bends his knee. So, you know, we really don't have to worry about Christianity because it's so weak. It just goes along with whatever, whatever is in power is what it's saying. And the real religion of our time is liberal universalism, to which he wants to, which he puts up against that, he puts white nationalism. White nationalism, this real struggle, he says, is between liberal universalism and white nationalism. Okay. So, these, white nationalist, homosexuals are, stand against liberal universalism, according to him. So he says, what would this religious landscape look like under white nationalist hegemony? Well, first, under white nationalism, there would be complete unity on the supreme importance of white racial preservation and progress. You know, he's trying to argue that his homosexual group there is going to be very, you know, important in preserving white racial, the white race somehow. And second, he says, there would be complete pluralism and tolerance in all unimportant matters. So under white nationalism, there would be complete pluralism and tolerance in all unimportant matters, just as under liberal universalism. So he admits that that is the case under liberal universalism, and he's saying that this should be the case under white nationalism also. And he describes what this pluralism would be like in this tolerance as the same as in liberal universalism: private enterprise, private life, freedom of thought, speech, and creativity. So, you know, what I pick out there is private life. So everybody would have their private life. You wouldn't interfere with anybody's private life. And, you know, what they were doing, particularly sexually, however they wanted to orient their life sexually, everybody would be tolerant of that because that was not interfering with white nationalism, with the nationalists, with racial it would not be interfering with the fact that the white race was the most important matter. This would be an unimportant matter. What you did in your private life is an unimportant matter, according to him. And creativity too, you know, these people are big on creativity, and so however they want to be creative in their life, then that would be all right too. Nobody would be interfering with that, which is what they don't like about fascist and national socialist type organizations, which he is actually presenting an alternative to that and still calling it something that's going to promote the white race. He says, as in antiquity, everybody would be free to explore mystery cults and foreign faiths as long as they do not undermine our race. So you'd have all this choice, which they want to have, but what they like about white racialism is that they like white men. And well, I'm not even sure I know that they want it to be male dominated. they want it to be male dominated. They don't like women. They don't want women to have any positions. They don't want women to be important even, except to reproduce the race. Now, I just have here something. Then Gregory Hood also wrote about Christianity recently on Countercurrents, and he mentioned homosexuality a couple of times. But let me find my lost my place. But it's not okay. It's not that he just says like that the modern world is becoming more Christian because of its in its universalism. And that, and he's saying that if in a few decades, Christians will be celebrating homosexuality in the same way they celebrate interracial marriage today. Christians don't celebrate interracial marriage. They may accept it, but they don't celebrate it, and they accept homosexuality too. So I don't see any difference. It's, you know, he acts like one is way ahead of the other. I don't see any difference between the two as far as the who's accepting it and who isn't. That's just some stuff I better pass by. All right, I'm gonna mention this thing by something that Hunter Wallace wrote in 2010. I know there's a lot of questions about Hunter Wallace. I'm not a fan of his. I'm not a fan of Greg Johnson's either. So but they were having on this thread at Majority Rights, they were having this big thing back and forth and accusing one another of each of being having a psychological meltdown and losing it and doing all kinds of terrible things. And they were accusing one another of this going back and forth. And it's a lot of drama. But I'm gonna read this part because I think it says a lot of what I would like to leave you with here about why homosexuals are negative for the white nationalist movement and why that's maybe a big part of what's wrong with the white nationalist movement is the homosexuals in it, because there's a whole lot of them in these places like this woman who wrote to me that might go to, that are not blogging, but also that are writing on forums and so on, and you don't know who they are, who are so anti-female and so over the top about certain things that they may not be sincere people, and they may be whatever they're doing to push the white nationalist movement away from being open or attractive to women. Now, Hunter is writing to Greg here, and he says, when that video of you at the Francis Parker Yockey Memorial was posted on Occidental Descent, you literally shit a brick at the thought that someone might see you. You know, it's been a lot of talk about how nobody knows what Greg Johnson looks like. There's no pictures of him anywhere. Obviously, he's been very careful to try to keep that private, so that nobody knows what he looks like. And he also, as I said last week, he had to use his real name to become editor of the Occidental Quarterly. But he didn't want to. He would not have used his real name if he didn't have to for that. And he's kind of sorry that his real name is out there. And he was trying to hide a lot of early information about himself, like when he was in a PhD program in Washington D.C. and where he was teaching down in Georgia, and a lot of things in the who he was associating with and so on. But I found all that eventually, and I had it in some comments at the White Network, but I'm not going to go into that right now. But this is all stuff he didn't want known about himself. And so he's saying that Hunter Wallace is saying that he didn't he didn't want to, he got upset. He thought that a picture of him would be, in a video, would be shown on the internet, I guess. And he also, Hunter also says, what happened to the Countercurrents radio show on Voice of Reason? Yeah, there was a, he backed out on that too. He says, oh, wait, that's right. That project was abandoned before the first episode because you were afraid of having too high a profile. Someone might hear the lisp in your voice. Well, they were kind of nasty to each other, but that's not the worst thing. Then he says, why doesn't, okay, Hunter asks the question, why doesn't the white nationalist movement go anywhere? Well, at first he says that he was just the thought that he's a coward, that just the thought of being seen on Vimeo or YouTube was very upsetting to him. Well, Hunter Wallace didn't want to be seen either, and he's used all kinds of pseudonyms and so on and different names, but still he says why didn't and he asks this question, why doesn't the nationalist, white nationalist movement go anywhere? And he says, elementary, dear Watson, it is because physical cowards like yourself don't have the courage and integrity to stand by their words. Just as Joe Sixpack watches television or sports to pass the time and entertain himself, which he considers fun, you pass the time with mental masturbation by reading Hitler, eating at German restaurants, reading French philosophers, and going to operas with that boyfriend of yours. Well, this is the kind of thing, and I was wasn't sure I'd read this, but the point I want to make is that that these people, I like the idea of the physical cowards, that these homosexuals are so covering themselves up, and they so much don't want to be, not much anything known about them, and they so much don't want to be seen, and they don't, often don't want to be heard, and they don't, you know, it doesn't, you can't make a movement go anywhere if you got too many of these people in it, and particularly if homosexuals see themselves as leaders, as the leaders. And that's why I say if this Countercurrent site ever just caves in and goes away, I think it will be a good thing. And I think that it's a good thing that we have some younger people who maybe are not as intellectual and as you know, in the last, well, I don't know, 20 years or so, I don't know, since I've been aware of it, there's been a large element of intellectualism in the white movement. And it hasn't gone anywhere either. It goes nowhere. So maybe it needs to get back to a more populist-based, issues-based, real-based footing with people, real people, who can get out there and talk about things. And so that's the only reason that I would bring this up tonight. I'm not somebody who's going to lead anything, but I think that what we need is something more basic and something that appeals to mainstream people and not all this super intellectualism, which is just for a certain segment who start having delusions about themselves. All right, I'm going to go on. I've already used up too much time. I want to talk about Joseph November, because this is a funny thing. On Saturday night, William Fink has his program at Christigenia.org. He has his program called, what is it called? Saturdays. Christigenia Saturdays. And he has a variety of topics. Sometimes it's Bible-based and sometimes it isn't. But he's been doing this thing about exposing the shills, and he's been he's had this thing going between him and Pastor Eli James, who is another Christian Identity big name and calls himself an authority on the internet. And they have fell out of favor with Bill split from him a couple of years ago based on some of this Christian Identity, you know, theories and so on, and actually on what they call well, I already use these terms, not internationalism, but universalism. And so there's been, Pastor Eli James has said a lot of bad things about Pastor Bill Fink. And Bill did a program. He's been doing these programs, but he had one this past Saturday, and I listened to it, and it was really funny, and it's interesting, too, because Bill and Sword Brethren prove, without a doubt, as Bill likes to say, that the man who calls himself Pastor Eli James and has such a big reputation, and who even now has a radio show on Republic Broadcasting Network, and I love to make fun of Republic Broadcasting Network, but this man is a Jew whose real name is Joseph November. And there's no doubt about it, obviously. It's for real. Bill has been saying that Eli James is Joe November for, well, as I recall, you know, hearing it over a year or something, maybe longer, but at least I'd say about a year. But now he has accumulated enough evidence to make anybody believe it. But then we know how true believers are. So if they don't want to believe it, they won't change their mind and they won't believe it. But I was listening to the program, and it just made me laugh all along at the way that Bill Fink was presenting his information. And Sword Brethren had some good lines, too. I recommend that you listen to that program if you're at all interested in this kind of thing. But Bill showed that that everything and anything online that is about Eli James, his ministry, his websites, you know, whatever he's got there, is owned and registered by someone named Joseph P. November. When I first heard Bill say that his name was Joe November, I thought he was joking because it just sounded like a joke. But now I know it's not a joke. And anyway, the addresses given are all the same address as Joseph November's in Chicago. There is such a person. And he has a wife and two daughters, and their addresses are listed at that same place, that home in Chicago. And it just, he kind of went on and on. He had this and he had that and the other thing. Even though he had enough to make you realize that this man's name is Joseph November. But then he went to the Facebook pages, and one daughter and some other websites, newly married people post their pictures up there and so on. And one of November's daughters, or Eli James' daughters, got married recently, and she married a non-white person, someone more like a Middle Easterner. And she, there are pictures of her and her husband on a certain wedding picture website. And her name is called November. She calls herself, what I don't remember her first name, you know, say Linda or something. Linda November married this man, and he has a kind of Middle Eastern sounding last name, and he doesn't look white. So Christian identity is all about the Israelites are all white people and us, and that we are the descendants of the Israelites, and that we are God's chosen people, and that no non-white can be a part of that. And now here's Joseph November, who is a Jew, and his daughter is married a Middle Easterner, and his other daughter is friends with some non-whites, and there's pictures on her Facebook page too. And then this married daughter told somewhere about how her name originated, the name November originated, that her family was Polish Jews or something near Poland, or they were in Poland, but maybe not only Polish. But they were, at some point in history, they were forced to select a last name for tax purposes. And her ancestors chose the name November. They just picked it out. She says they're the only Jews with that name. They're the only people in the world. No, the only Jews, I guess. I don't know. I've never known anybody named November. That's why when I first heard it, I thought it was just a joke. But she says that only Jews, that she says that all Novembers, all people with the name of November are related. There's only her family. Only her family, her family line, has that name. And that they're Jewish. And so, as Bill says, Eli James has nowhere to hide. And the other funny thing is that at the end of the program, his program, he played a clip of John Kaminsky on Daryl Bradford Smith's radio program. And I don't know when exactly it was, but I was going to go and look for it and see if I could find it. And no, but I don't think it was from a long time ago. I think it was a fairly recent one. Daryl is still doing radio programs, I guess. I've totally forgotten about that guy. I never go to his site or pay any attention to him, but he's on this show, and it might have been a while back, I don't know. Daryl is saying that Carolyn Yeager says, I am a Zionist Jew. Well, you see, I included Daryl Bradford Smith in my disinfo agents on the internet shows that I did quite a while back. And, you know, Daryl just lies. When Daryl gets on his radio show, he says things that he doesn't even know. He just starts, stuff just starts coming out of his mouth. He doesn't care whether it's accurate or not, obviously. He'll just say it and it won't be true, and he doesn't even correct himself later, and people don't even bother. I don't think people bother correcting him. So much gets passed on the internet. So much gets by, and nobody, I mean, I know I've said things that I realize were wrong. Sometimes I misspeak, and nobody ever said anything to me. I realize it myself, and then I try to say something about it later on the next show, but and correct myself. But nobody would correct me. People just passes them by. They're not that particular, I guess. So Daryl said on this show, Carolyn Yeager says I'm a Zionist Jew. Well, see, he's lying, because I never said he was a Zionist Jew. I said he was a liar, and I said he was a disinfo. I said that he's I never would call somebody a Zionist Jew. That's not what I use for a bad name to call somebody in my name calling. That's what people call me. People call me Zionist or a Jew or a Zionist Jew, but I don't call him that. And I don't believe I ever called him a Jew. I would have called him someone who goes along with a lot of information that the Jews like, that the Jews put out. I did my big beef with Daryl Bradford Smith was all his anti-Hitler stuff. He likes to post all this kind of stuff I was talking about in the first hour, about Hitler was a Jew, Hitler was a Zionist, Hitler was a Rothschild, Hitler would have been a cultist and all that kind of stuff. He posts that stuff, and that was my big gripe with him. But I never called him a Zionist Jew. And then let's see. All right, I said all that. John Kaminsky said, and Daryl agreed with him, that John Kaminsky said I was a Christian identity. I was Christian identity, and he wouldn't trust me for 5 minutes or 5 seconds, maybe. I don't know. And Smith agreed with him. I wouldn't trust that Carolyn Yeager for 5 minutes either. That's all, you know. And Bill was apologizing that part was in what he put on his show, but I don't care. It doesn't bother me. This is just more of the entertainment as far as I'm concerned. I had to laugh at that too, because anybody that knows me knows both. I can understand people thinking I was Christian identity. Well, I was more open to it for a while, but I just can't really get involved in it. So get involved in that kind of thing. So I, you know, I'm not. But I don't mind if somebody, I did straighten people out about it. I don't like people saying things about me that aren't true if they're not friendly toward me, you know. Well, this what little time I have left, I can't talk about all the Germany stuff I was going to talk about. See, I have all this good stuff, but glad I got to talk about Joe November, and I want to end up by talking about Mark Weber and his IHR, the Institute for Historical Review, and his news and comment that he sends, that he mails out. I've been wanting to say this for a long time, you know. I criticize Mark Weber a lot because all he does is send out that news and comment email a couple times a week. Now he's maybe three times a week. And it's just stuff taken from the, stories from the internet. And he just reposts about seven or so of them on a page. And then he puts the parts, he takes a section from the article, usually the beginning of it, sometimes somewhere in the middle though, and adds that to the headline. And that's it. And he calls it news and comment, but I said, there's no comment. That's not comment. The new, you know, he's got the headline and then the news, the story, part of the story is there. There's no comment. He doesn't comment on it. He's too lazy even to write a comment on these stories. He just sends them out as they are. And that's supposed to be, a real service, to the people that he's asking then, at least once a week, he sends out the request for donations. So he's asking for money, but that's all that he's giving. And I think that's kind of pathetic that he shouldn't call it news and comment if he's not going to be commenting. Well, ladies and gentlemen, thank you for listening to my program tonight. I sometimes am a little bit weary. I've been very tired all day today, and I didn't know how good this show was going to be, but I get a buzz on about certain things, and I just can't settle down until I talk about it on the radio. But I hope I hope I've said enough about some of these topics, and I won't bring them up again. And nobody called in and wanted to talk about them with me either. So remember that tomorrow night is Tan Stoffel on his good show. And then Thursday night, tune in to our with Hadding and I on the International Jew. We've got a very good chapter coming up. So once again, this is Carolyn Yeager saying good night for the Heretics Hour. Good night.
Thanks for listening, and be sure to visit Carolyn's website at carolynyager.com.